This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. A recent poll by the British Croquet Association found the average croquet player to be 68 years old. The pollsters warned that if the sport does not attract a younger audience, it could disappear altogether by the year 2037. We are, of course, smack in the middle of summer, and it's a great time to get out and play lawn games like croquet, cornhole, or bocce, games that have survived in some cases for thousands of years. Now, a few alternative lawn games are gaining momentum, while others fall out of favor. And yet all of them share a space with new forms of technological recreation. Paul Tukey is co-author of Tag, Toss, and Run, 40 Classic Lawn Games, and joins us now to talk about the fascinating history behind some of our favorite summer sports and how our relationship with these games is changing in the 21st century. Paul, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
It is crazy to hear that croquet has become somewhat passé. How far back does that sport go?
Probably about 150 years. It dates back to England, and various people lay claim to its invention, but probably about 1850, 1840, somewhere in there. A lot of the games that were originally popular in this country do come to us from Great Britain. Obviously, we settled here. A lot of ancestors came here, and croquet was certainly one of those first great games that everybody played. And it seemed like everybody's garage had a croquet set when I was growing up back in the 60s and 70s. And now that just isn't true as much anymore.
What are some of the oldest lawn games that we still play in some form or another today?
Well, the oldest game known on the planet's bocce. It was found in the Egyptian tombs. It's somewhere between 5 and 10,000 years old, as near as we can tell. It may be even older than that. And that is still very, very popular around the world. It's obviously a very simple game with four large balls and one small ball, and anybody can play it of all ages. And so that one still holds up today as a game that folks love and still enjoy. As far as other older ones, I mean, Lendon Bridge, that game is probably 1,000 years. That's a game that the little children typically play. A lot of kindergartners love to play that one. Tug of war, you know, just an old rope that you can pull back and forth with groups of people. That game is very old. And we have 40 games in the book, and I would say probably a dozen of them go back at least 200 years, and some are 1,000 or more.
Glad you mentioned tug of war, because it seems like a lot of these games are inspired by or modeled after military sort of activity or war. What's that connection between lawn games and the battlefield?
I think it's a fascination that children have, and it's they like to play and they like to fantasize, and it's very, very healthy, I think, and just very, very natural. I watched a Clint Eastwood movie with my daughters this weekend and introduced them to Clint Eastwood, and I was wincing when Clint would shoot a bad guy, but you have to explain it's just a movie. But they were really, really fascinated about why people don't like each other, and I do think that that's just something that people do like to talk about. Unfortunately, war is part of our collective history, our collective culture, and children like to play it out in an innocent way in their backyards, and that's why there is that imaginary connection to a lot of these games. And in fact, some of these games, like tug of war, have been banned. It's part of the reason for the decline in popularity of some of them, is that some of them are deemed to be too dangerous for today's children to play, even though I'm a 54-year-old man and I've survived all of them.
Dodgeball, for example, that's been banned
dodgeball.
In a lot of places.
Dodgeball is, and you wonder, is that an appropriate game to be playing, even though we certainly did it back in the playgrounds in Maine when I was a child.
Were you surprised to discover the origins of some of those games, that
everybody seems
to
play.
Yeah, I mean, when we started the project, it was I didn't want to relegate an old-fashioned outdoor childhood to memory. And every culture has their own games. And some of them are the same version of the same games. Like bocce is universal. Every culture plays bocce. But then you find these great games like Kube and Mulki from Scandinavian countries, and you find Sepak Takraw from the Asian world, and so that is very, very interesting and exciting to engage with these other cultures and find out that these are really great games too.
Well, kids used to play these kind of games. You know, we were just sent outside to play games on hot summer days. How do you think technology and ideas about parenting have changed the way that we play lawn games and how we view them in general?
Well, I do think that the computer has taken over, sadly. I've met parents who, they look at the book and they all say, I used to play that, but I don't let my child go outside anymore because I'm afraid they're going to get Lyme disease, for example. Or maybe they put pesticides on their lawn and they don't want the kids playing on the grass. They grew the lawn because they want it to look nice, but they just don't want the kids to go out there and play. So culturally, we have a malaise right now, and we have an epidemic of obesity in this country. And again, I think it's back to let's celebrate these games and don't just expect that the kids are going to go out there and find these games on their own. I think we need to lend a guiding hand. And I can tell you, I just left my camp in Maine last week, and we played so many of these games, and my five-year-old is the first one in the morning to be, I'm not even awake yet, and she's tugging me out the door to go play games. And I love that. We had we don't even bring the computer to camp with us. And it's that one week of really where it hasn't changed, life hasn't changed since my childhood, because all you can do is swim and play games.
If these lawn games of the baby boomers are indeed falling out of fashion, you know, like croquet and bocce, what are some of those that are becoming more popular?
Well, the one that's really two, Kube and Mulki, and they're from, Kube is a Scandinavian game, a Scandinavian war game, and Mulki is a Finnish Skittles game. It's a counting game. They both involve underhand tossing of wooden objects. And Kube really latched on up in Minnesota first, and then Wisconsin, and really college students started. They learned it in college. Maybe they knew it from a notch. One gentleman whose name escapes me, I mentioned him in the book, he's really credited with bringing Kube into the country. He learned it from a Norwegian uncle, and he made a homemade set. And then he went from Minnesota to Wisconsin, and they started having these tournaments. And I can tell you that Kube is a game that nobody's ever seen before until recent years in this country. And it's really fascinating to watch it. It's very, very strategic. Play it much like bocce or bowling, or anybody can play it. I was out in Los Angeles and we had a tournament. My friend's 19-year-old son was hosting a tournament out there, and the audience just started building from 2 to 3 people to dozens and dozens of people, and people wanted to try it. And so I think these are new. They are exciting. It's a little bit more complicated than bocce in the strategy, and I think that maybe goes back to the video game thing, where a lot of these video games do have strategies to them, and probably Kube suits today's teenager better than bocce does, because it is more interesting and it is more war related. You know, you are trying to capture the king and, you know, metaphorically kill the enemy. And so I think the college students really like that.
Paul Tukey, co-author of Tag, Toss, and Run, 40 Classic Lawn Games. Paul, thank you for being with us.
Well, I appreciate it. Take
care. I'm just warning you, if you come to New Hampshire again, I'm a cornhole champion.
Oh, really? Well, bring it on.
Well, as Paul mentioned, one lawn game currently sweeping America's greens is Kube. Sometimes called Viking chess, Kube combines elements of throwing games like horseshoes and cornhole with the strategy of games like checkers or chess. One New Hampshire town where Kube is making waves is Peterborough, New Hampshire, the site of what may have been New Hampshire's first Kube tournament. Producer Taylor Quimby spoke to the woman who may be responsible for bringing this Nordic lawn game to the grassy greens of the Granite State.
So hi, I'm Elin Johansson, and I live in Peterborough, but grew up in Sweden.
So when did you first play Coop? Do you remember?
I think it was probably sometime in the early 90s, maybe when I was 7 or 8 years old. That's when it started to become popular in Sweden. You started maybe to buy them in some hardware stores and some rare stores in the beginning. But then in the early 90s, you started seeing it in every gas station and every store everywhere. And I mean, every family was paying it. I was never really competitive with playing. I was the youngest one of four brothers. And they were very competitive and they always won. So I think I learned to lose. I think Sweden is such an important game because we really value the summers in Sweden because it is such a dark, dark time during the winter. And so during the summer when we have light almost 24 hours a day, we can play it well into midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning without anything stopping us.
Now, when did you come to the States?
When I was 19, I moved to Brooklyn, New York. So for 11 years, I lived in New York and never played Coop. And not until I moved to Peterborough, I just remembered how much I missed the game. I had a backyard. I missed it. Maybe I wanted to find my roots in a way, and I bought a game.
And so where'd you get it?
I actually bought it off Amazon, and there are a lot of different options there. Now they're actually making games in Peterborough, beautiful wooden games, and it's easy to make yourself.
Have you noticed that there seems to be this sudden interest in the United States in Coop?
Well, I didn't really talk about it for many years in Brooklyn, but I started to see it in parks in Brooklyn. People started playing it, and then now when I've been introducing it, it seems like everyone has heard about it once.
You told me about a game that you played in Brooklyn not too long ago, and they were you said you weren't very competitive. You heard that they were very competitive.
These are very professional people working in a very competitive city. So immediately they were out with lasers, ropes, measuring everything. Just, you know, it was... they used me as a rule book, but I don't know the rules very well, so I made them up as we went along. It was almost like a little fights here and there, but everyone loved it, and I think they're all addicted at this point.
Do you think there's a reason that people might be interested in this? Is it just that it's new to us, or is there something about the game itself?
I think it's more fun than croquet or bocce or any of these other games because it... You need a little more tactic when you play it. You need a little more skill. It hasn't lost its popularity in Sweden in 25 years. So I think it's going to continue to grow here. And it's just a more challenging game, I think, but still very simple.
And any hopes for yourself that you're going to be at the top of the pack in the Peterborough competitions?
No, I've given that up. I like to spread the word around, and there are definitely people in Peterborough that taking the lead. They're going to be the best.
Producer Taylor Quimby there speaking with Elin Johansson, a native of Sweden who now lives in Peterborough, New Hampshire.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Campfire songs, hiking, canoeing, first crushes, vaguely Native American-themed games, they are all quintessential summer camp experiences. Now iPhones are increasingly being packed along with the bug spray and sneakers as kids set off for sleepaway summer camp, the place where enjoying the natural world is supposed to be the chief activity. Brett Burke joins us now to talk about how smartphones are ruining the free-range life at summer camp. And Brett, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So what was summer camp like for you as a kid?
You know, I went to summer camp in the 70s and 80s. And if you've seen any of the movies that are reflective of that experience during that period, like Little Darlings or Meatballs or Friday the 13th, it was a somewhat milder version of that.
But still sound wild?
It was relatively wild. I mean, it was, you know, I think the youth of that era had sort of appropriated all of the revolutionary jargon and liberation of the, you know, liberation movements that happened in the 60s and early 70s. And so we were sort of, you know, separate from adult power. Any sort of adult infringement on our sense of self was, you know, seen as something to oppose, you know, like fighting the man.
Did you ever call your parents when you were at sleepaway camp?
Call my parents?
Yeah.
No. That's a shocking question. How could that have even happened? I don't even know if there was a phone at my camp. There was an issue one time when my brother went to camp with me as well, and he broke a bone, something in his hand or his arm, and the camp had to call my mother at some point to either clarify some insurance information or deal with some sort of medical thing. This was after the bone had been set, and they called her, and they were like, oh, you know, we just want to clarify the insurance information. And she was like, well, can I talk to him? And she wanted to talk to him basically to find out if he was okay to stick around for the second session of camp, the second month of camp. And they were like, oh, you know, it's against camp policy to talk to campers. And anyway, how would we know which one he is? And my mom was like, he's the one with the cast. But there was no other, there wasn't communication in the other direction. You certainly never talked to your parents at camp. You could fill out one of those sort of Mad Lib style letters or whatever that you would try to send home in the hope that perhaps someone would respond with candy or some sort of other illicit substance. But there was definitely no communication from child to parent via the phone.
Well, now kids are packing their cell phones and iPhones to some camps. Some of them actually ban them. It's a bit more structured and a bit more tame, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a variety of different things going on here. You know, I'm a child development person, you know, and I wrote a parenting book and have all of this experience with dealing with kids and families. From that perspective, I think what we're seeing sort of this interesting confluence of things where there's the ability to have constant supervision and connection to your child, or at least, you know, the idea of it, right, that you can be in touch with them at any point, at any place where they might be. Given that, people come to expect and rely upon that, the idea of that existing. When you're used to the notion that you are always able to be in touch with your child, the idea of being out of touch with your child is somehow this sort of crazy rupture, right?
Right, but do you think it's the kids then that want the phones, or the parents?
Well, I would say it's the parents, generally. I mean, kids like to have communication. They're used to that, and kids as young as, you know, 9, 8, oftentimes generally have cell phones of their own. But my sense is, from researching this and from looking at, like, the rules and the way that these things are stated in terms of family guidelines and camp handbooks and things like that, you know, it's pretty much, if the camp bans phones, the understanding would be that the parent would probably, being the authority figure in the home, collect the phone before the child goes to camp.
Yeah.
So if a child shows up at camp with a phone, it means the parent has probably neglected to do that duty or has insisted that the child bring the phone to camp. They all have these marginally putative statements that are like, the phone will be returned to your parent at their expense. But my sense is that kids go to camp and they're like involved in whatever is going on in camp. They don't need to know at every moment what's going on. Although I did just today, coincidentally, drop my niece off at camp. She goes to a performing arts camp not too far away from my country house in upstate New York.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that at her camp, they take away the phone for the first week. And then after that, you can get it out of a lockbox during a certain time period each day or some portion of time during each week. And she was telling me that she had convinced her sister to compose a daily text that would include an Instagram photo from Kim Kardashian's feed, as well as some of her top tweets for that day. And she would send that to her, so she would be able to receive that information.
Thank goodness she won't miss that.
I know, exactly. And that changes on a day-to-day basis with wild variation, as you can imagine.
Well, you know, the whole purpose of summer camp was, I thought anyway, you learn how to be a little bit independent. You wean yourself off your parents. It sounds like, in many cases, parents need to wean themselves off their children when they're at summer camp.
Yeah, and I think that's the case with contemporary parenting in general right now. Kids aren't leading the way on a lot of these things. Kids come into the world not really exactly knowing how any of these social organizational skills work, and parents are the ones that teach them. So if parents are demonstrating that the tether needs to be constant and consistent, that's what kids are going to be used to, and that's what they're going to come to expect. You know, I'm not saying that kids don't like to be in touch with their family, but I'm saying that from that developmental perspective, at a time when you would ordinarily be sowing the seeds of your own independence, there is this parental tether that exists now that may not have existed in the past.
So what do you think that does to the experience of summer camp?
I think that in some ways it can diminish that sense of independence and creating your own life. If you're tethered back to your friends and family members at home, then it's harder to, as we all know from any experience, it's harder to then immerse yourself in the culture that's separate or different from that. So I think that there can be some ways in which you can remain connected and tethered to the Kim Kardashian Instagram feed may not be a wonderful example, but to those kinds of things, or to familial engagement and to engagement with friends who may not be there. Going to camp for the first time or going to camp at all when you're younger can be a jarring experience, and you know, you don't want kids to feel abandoned, obviously, or let off. But today, you know, we were leaving my niece at camp, and she had already turned in her cell phone, and they had given her her claim ticket, you know, or whatever it was. So we were leaving, and my partner and I, we were like, okay, bye. We couldn't say, like, text us or call us or whatever. And for a moment, it felt strange to just be, like, walking away without having what comes next. And did you get settled in? Did you put your underwear in the proper drawer? Did any of your bunkmates try to shiv you, you know, or anything like that? Then I was like, she's fine. She's 15 years old. She's at camp. She's been going to camp for years. I'm sure nothing terrible is going to happen. And she needs that sense of independence and that sense of being separated from us.
Well, Brett, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Brett Burke, he's a contributing writer for Vanity Fair and author of The Gay Uncle's Guide to Parenting. And you'll find a link to read his article at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. That's a clip from the song The Good Life by 3 Days Grace, which, according to a recent study, is the dumbest song of the decade. The study goes on to conclude that pop music is getting more stupid, pointing to a decrease in lyrical complexity and the average number of syllables used. Since the study was released, a number of media outlets have gleefully reported the results as confirmation that contemporary pop is stupid. Others call the findings racist, sexist, and elitist. Joining us to sort it all out is Chris Wright, who wrote about the study and its fallout for the Ideas section of the Boston Globe. Chris, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hello, thank you. Nice to be here.
So according to this study, what makes The Good Life such an especially stupid song?
Well, first of all, we have to look at, a little bit at what this study was trying to do and who conducted it. The study itself isn't as interesting in the end as the sort of some of the questions that it raises. It's a little bit sort of junky science, in all honesty. What it did was it fed lyrics of popular songs over the last decade into online analytical tools like Flesh Kincaid and gauged these lyrics based on things like you said, number of syllables used and the complexity of sentences, but it didn't take into account things like meaning or metaphor and you know, things that really do give a song its soul as well as its sort of intellectual sort of quality.
This Flesh Kincaid scale, this is what it does is assign a grade-based reading
right.
level. So, and who did the study, by the way?
It was it's an online ticketing agency, and the guy who did it, he's a young guy. I spoke to him. He's what they were doing was drumming up publicity really for their site, and they got it. I mean, it was picked up by a 1,000 media outlets, and it did sort of spark a conversation about what lyrics are, what they're supposed to do. You know, the main finding was that we're looking at lyrics dropping a grade point or two from an average grade level of 3.25 in 2005 to 2.75 in 2014, half a grade level, not a massive drop.
So that's like third grade to second grade.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So you looked at the intelligence of some older songs using the same methodology. So let's hear a track listeners will probably recognize, and then we'll talk with you about what kind of grade it got.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand?
So that was Bob Dylan's Blowing in the Wind. You analyzed it using the Flesh Kincaid test. Now, what kind of grade did that get?
What I found was that was deemed suitable by these standards for kids who were around 11 years old.
Uh-huh.
And you compared that to another song, Trey Song's LOL Smiley Face. How did that stack up?
That was deemed to be more intelligent. You had to be about 15 in order to understand what he was talking about in that song. I hope you have a clip from that. Yeah, so there you have a kind of a flaw in the methodology of this report. But like I say, it helped raise this question. You know, why are lyrics good? When are they good? What does intelligence mean? If you look at the Cole Porter, Strange Dear But True Dear, When I'm Close to You Dear, Stars Fill the Sky, that's on a par with Bar Bar Black Sheep in terms of its complexity. But they're wonderful lyrics. They're poetic. They're full of visual sort of richness. They fit the music perfectly. It's a wonderful lyric, but it wouldn't score very highly on Flesh Kincaid.
But we know lyrics, you know, I mean, I'm thinking of ooh, ee, ooh, ah, ah, ting, tang, walla, walla, bing, bang.
Mm-hmm. I mean, right. I remember. Great lyrics.
But I mean, a lot of pop songs use nonsense words or repetitive gobbledygook to make a catchy hook. That's what it's all about. I'm thinking of Hanson's mbop or Kesha's blah, blah, blah. Let's hear a little bit of that. How can that blah, blah? I mean, if these verbal tools are not used to make a song smarter, then why do songwriters use them?
Well, let's look. I mean, if you look at the history of music, and I'm no expert, but you think about African tribal music, you think about Gregorian chants, all of which relies a lot on the quality of the sounds, the hypnotic repetition of sounds. I mean, that's what music is. You're not sitting down and reading a Russian novel, are you? You're listening to music. Eminem's a really good example. He was one of the sort of highest scoring artists in the whole study and was the highest hip hop artist. But the genius of Eminem is the way he fits his lyrics to the music. They're not really, in terms of content, they're not particularly sophisticated, but the way he adjusts syllables to the rhythm and the way he syncopates that and the way he messes with rhythm and sound and meaning makes him, in my mind, and also Seamus Heaney once agreed, he's a lyrical genius, I think. He's a poet.
Well, does intellect have a place in pop music? I mean, it seems to me that the more overwrought songs get intellectually, the less good they are.
Well, the song Da-Da-Da-Da by The Police came up, and that's a wonderful song, and it does have some sort of fairly complex thinking in it, but Sting started to lose me. As his career wore on, he got more and more cerebral to the point where I couldn't listen to him. So it can certainly go too far. If you cut the emotional out or weaken the emotional because you're trying to be too intellectual, then you end up with a bad song.
I want to go back to what you said about genres a little bit earlier, mentioned Eminem. Mm-hmm. The study also compared different genres of music against one another, found hip-hop stupider than country, Lady Gaga dumber than Adele, and Kanye dumber than Drake. Based on what?
Well, this is where things get a little bit dodgy, because country and western ranked as the most intelligent genre of music out there. And the reason for that, as the author of the study admitted, was that it tends to use words like Mississippi and cigarette. So, you know, it was deemed one of the more intelligent. And of course, when you listen to some of the lyrics involved, they're not, you know, massively intellectual or cerebral.
This study was not published in a respectable journal. I mean, it was some guy's blog post, and its methodology dubious at best, but it really touched a nerve. Now, why do you think so many people were hot to jump in on this debate over the intelligence of pop music?
Well, number one is people are always willing to jump into a debate about how things aren't as good as they used to be, especially once you reach a certain age. But there's also this fear that our kids are sort of spinning off into their own sort of universe, which is filled with drugs and sex and God knows what else. Pop music becomes a scapegoat for the illicit thoughts and deeds of youth. So when we criticize pop music, we're also criticizing the habits of the people who listen to it, I think.
Chris, do you have a favorite dumb pop song?
I actually like that song by Culture Club, War is Stupid and People are Stupid. And I haven't been able to get rid of that song from my head since I wrote that line, because it's a really, really good pop song. It's one of those things that just gets into your brain and stays there, just, you know, sort of like a squatter. It moves in and it refuses to leave, and that must mean something. And then, of course, you have the Milkshake song.
My milkshake is better than yours.
Yeah. And I just challenge anyone to think about that song and not be stuck with it for a couple of days.
Well, Chris, thanks a lot for passing on Milkshake. Now it's stuck.
Good. I'm happy to help.
Chris Wright, he's a writer and editor, and you'll find a link to read his article for the Boston Globe, Are Pop Songs Getting Dumber? That's at wordofmouthradio.org.